All right, are we live?
Well, the record light is on, so I'm going to assume that means we're live.
Oh, I think people are filtering into their seats now. We've got 199, 211. All right, so we're gonna give a moment for the numbers to kind of settle out. Those who are here and can hear us, thank you so much for joining us. All right, 237 and holding. All right. I think the crowd has settled in. Thanks everybody for, now it's increasing again. I can't stare at those numbers. It's just going to make me crazy. All right. So hi everybody. I'm Michael Littman. I'm the Division Director for Information and Intelligent Systems in the SIES Directorate at the National Science Foundation. And we've been hosting office hours about activities within the division for the last couple of years, about once a month. But we have a special guest with us today to talk about the Artificial Intelligence Executive Order, and that is Wade Shen, who is currently serving as the head of the National AI Initiatives Office, if I'm not mistaken, and has been involved in artificial intelligence research and supporting research in various ways for a big chunk of his career. We're delighted to have him as in his current role and delighted to have him in the office hours today. So what we're going to do is give Wade a chance to kind of lay out the story, kind of get everybody updated on that, and to accept questions through the Q&A mechanism of the webinar. And I'll kind of feed questions to him along with the other NSF people who are helping me out with the call. So yeah, so let me just turn it over to Wade to let us know what's up with this. What's this executive order thing and how is it relevant to the research community?
Yeah, so what's up with this? Well, as many of you know, the administration has been taking a series of actions when it comes to AI and both the opportunity and the risks associated with AI. And the executive order is the second of those actions. So earlier this year, sometime during the summer, the exact dates I can't even remember at this point anymore, we worked with the companies to come to a series of voluntary commitments around how they would ensure that the models that they build, especially the biggest models that the industry is building, are safe for Americans. And the executive order is a follow-on set of actions meant to codify a number of those commitments into executive status as directed by the executive branch of government. But we also recognize that this isn't the end point of all the things that need to happen. As many of you have probably heard, the EU is in the process of drafting legislation to regulate AI and to also ensure that it is productively used. And I suspect that we here in the United States will have similar legislation that comes down the pike. We think that's going to be necessary in order to turn many of the provisions of the executive order into more permanent provisions that are codified in law, but also there are just regulatory tools that are necessary for Congress to enact and funding that Congress needs to be able to enact in order to make a number of the vision of how we can actually make AI safe possible. But what I want to do is just sort of step into just a brief moment, an overview of what the executive order, which was just released about a month ago, tries to do, and how that impacts the R&D community, both in terms of what it needs in terms of feedback from the R&D community, and how responsible R&D can happen under the protections that are guaranteed in the EO. So first of all, first and foremost, the primary objective of the EO is to protect Americans. And so if you look at the details of the EO engages in a number of things to try to make sure that happens. One has to do with the release of models, AI models into production, especially models that might have some risk associated with them. These, by the EO's language, are called dual-use foundation models, and it requires that those kinds of models be tested, the aspects of how they were trained be disclosed, and that they adhere to certain safety standards that are to be defined by the folks at the Department of Commerce. In addition to that, content that is generated by generative AI systems, especially of this variety, require labeling standards associated with them, so that it is clear that content being generated by AI systems is generated by AI systems. In addition to that, that they bear a certain kind of watermarking, so that if people do attempt to remove those kinds of labels, that there's a way to rediscover whether or not that content is generated by AI. And then ultimately, these systems are required to be tested in terms of how their systemic properties behave, in terms of how they could be used for discrimination or abusive surveillance, or how they could be privacy violating if used the wrong way. So in their uses, how those uses can become pathological and therefore require some kind of standard and or testing. So without getting into the details of how that's implemented, it's implemented across many, many, many provisions of the EO. The EO is very, very long. It affects a number of different agencies that have different responsibilities in terms of setting standards and or setting regulations and or setting the example of how to use AI systems in these ways that are safe. And for how to evaluate these AI systems and for how to conduct release disclosures and so on. Without getting into those details, that's the broad brushstrokes of the work that the primary provisions of the EO try to encompass. Now, on top of that, there are provisions meant to protect workers and labor. And the fact is that even with safe systems, we know that there are very likely to be displacements associated with AI changing the nature of labor in terms of its adoption and its ability to automate lots of jobs that we previously might have thought weren't automatable. And so a number of issues come into play there. One is, what are the exact effects? I don't think we all know exactly what the long-term effects of these AI systems being adopted will look like. But we need to study that carefully, and we need to understand the societal implications of that. And the EO calls for exactly that. In addition to that, there are some really tricky questions that involve copyrighted material, the use of copyrighted materials to train AI systems, and therefore, what does that portend for anything that gets generated by these AI systems if they ingested copyright material during their training processes? And so standards associated with AI-generated IP, AI-generated copyrighted material that is potentially copyrighted because it was trained on copyrighted material, et cetera, and all of the various issues associated with derivative IP are part of those provisions of the EO. And we'll see that the EO asks us to collectively devise standards associated with that. And then lastly, I would say that there are two other buckets of activities that are associated, that are in this EO, and they're really associated with how to make AI more effective and how to innovate and take advantage of this technology that we have more societally. One has to do with use of AI in government. So that is very specific. The fact is that many government agencies want to be able to use these AI systems, but they don't know how to do that safely. They don't know how to do it effectively. They don't know when they can do that. They don't know, how to protect data when they do that. And so the EO sets up a number of standards for how that should happen. But beyond that, the EO recognizes that there are real needs to develop application areas for AI and AI technologies in specific application areas that are not well supported by industry as it stands today. Think of these as civil society applications, government applications, applications that are too early for commercialization. All of those classes of applications need support. And support in the EO comes in a couple of forms. One form it comes in is the expansion of the AI research institutes at NSF and the development of the NAIR through a pilot effort that is being conducted by the interagency led by NSF and DOE. And so These efforts are about creating an infrastructure that could enable application research and then funding and direction for application-specific research in areas that we think are strategically critical to the nation, but are probably not going to be addressed by commercialization alone. And so those aspects of the EO fall into the category of more effective use of AI. And then lastly, I'll just say that in addition to the effective use of AI, we realize that in order to make this all happen, we need people. We need people that understand AI systems. We need people that can build AI technologies and improve them. And then we need people that can deploy them. And so the EO envisions a talent surge in government to help deploy AI into government, but it also envisions and creates streamlined processes for bringing people into the United States who have these kinds of skills, either through training programs for foreign students or through relaxed and incentivized immigration policies for bringing in people who already have those skills but want jobs in the United States in the AI space. On top of that, we recognize that many jobs are going to be converted into either AI-enabled jobs or AI-requiring jobs. And as a result, there's a need for training programs there within the United States for American citizens that are already here and American residents. And the EO provides for provisions to do exactly that. Now, I'm going to stop talking about the contents of the EO. You can all read the EO and you don't have to anymore, because all 111 pages have been summarized by many people who have had a chance to go through that in detail and understand the policy implications and so on. But what I'm much more interested in is how does this affect you all, and how does it mobilize the larger R&D community in the United States to be thinking about some of the core problems in the EO? Because if you look at a lot of the EO, there are a lot of provisions that require guidance and decisions that are not yet made in terms of both the definition of certain aspects of systems, the evaluation methods that are necessary for high and low risk systems, the kind of infrastructure that's needed to support AI development and R&D across the United States, both at universities and research labs, and the design of core technologies that ensure trustworthy and safe systems in AI that we don't necessarily have today. So I'll just mention a couple of these that I think are super important. One is that the EO makes a core definition around systems that are potentially high risk versus systems that are not so high risk. And it calls those high-risk systems dual-use foundation models, but it doesn't actually say exactly what a long-term definition of dual-use foundation model is. And what I mean by that is that it says, well, here's a compute threshold. We think that models beyond this compute threshold might be risky, but we also recognize that that might not be a good proxy for real risk. So why don't we all figure out what's a better proxy for real risk, work with commerce, and determine what a better standard is going forward. And that standard can be adjusted over time. And that standard, by the way, has already had an RFI associated with it, and its associated evaluation measures have an RFI associated with it, been put out by NIST and the Department of Commerce. And largely that the purpose of that is to engage you all, the research community, to help us think about what are the right definitions for models like this? What are the real correlates of risk or the direct measures of risk that we might use in order to better define these thresholds? Now, on top of that, there is a need for figuring out how to evaluate these systems in terms of their actual safety. And that involves both the design of evaluation strategies and metrics and tests. And all of that, I think, is still a research question. How do we do that effectively for these systems so that we're not surprised when we deploy them in the field To date, I don't think anybody has come up with methods that are so robust that they survive the millions of people deployment test, as I call it, which is once I put it out in front of millions of people, something bad happens, and it happens relatively quickly, right? And so how do we avoid that happening with testing protocols and or evaluation protocols and or assurance methods that allow that to happen? That's an open question. We do not know the answer to that. We need your help to go and figure out how to do that. Similarly, there are questions around content provenance and labeling and what the standards should be for that. All of those still involve development and research in terms of the underlying methods. On top of that, there are methods for privacy preservation, discrimination detection, and debiasing that, again, are all somewhat basic research questions. In addition to all of the uses of AI that I mentioned earlier that we think are necessary for non-commercial purposes, all of these are places and opportunities for research to engage. Now, some of you may be worried that the safety provisions in the EO might restrict some of your work. I think I can assure you that most, if not all, of the models that you are likely to build to date don't fall into the categories of dual use foundation models that require the same kinds of controls that these larger systems do. And I suspect that many of you, as you're doing R&D, are also not releasing those models in the sense of releasing them to the public and making their risks available publicly. But you know, the intersection of those two things is also definable in part by you by providing guidance to NIST and to the Department of Commerce in terms of how those definitions should be set. And so what I would encourage all of you all to do is to engage with us here today, which is what I hope the rest of this conversation will be, and to engage with the various agencies that have a part to play in that. And I can help you find who those agencies are. So with that, I'm going to stop. There are many more details that I could go through, but I'm not going to. Instead, what I would like to do is to turn it back to Michael, and maybe he can open it up to questions for you all, and we can have a discussion about this.
Wait, thanks so much. Yeah, so we're getting questions coming in through the Q&A. I have a couple questions myself too, which may step on the toes of some of the question askers, but they're things that I think would be really great if you could help address. So you just mentioned this notion that probably most researchers are working on models that don't really fall into the dual use foundation model category. They're not trained on the number of cycles or using the number of cycles that are specified in the executive order. And so it's not so directly relevant to them. It's really pointed at industry. One possible exception to that, though, is that the number of cycles before you have to report it for training a biological model or a model using biological data is actually lower than for text. Yeah. And I know some folks in the sort of computational biology community have done some back of the envelope calculations, and they are worried that in fact they do trip over that boundary and that they would be subject to the constraints listed in the EO. Do we know? I think what the EO says is if you do that, it's not that you can't do it, but you have to report it. But we don't know who to report it to and how to report.
Yeah.
Is that known?
So correct and correct. The EO defines dual use foundation models, two different thresholds in the tentative early stage definitions of those dual use foundation models as being compute threshold based. The compute threshold for the largest non-biological models is 10 to the 26th. In terms of number of compute flops, and it's 10 to the 23rd in terms of number of compute flops for biological sequence models. So it's our understanding that none of the commercial entities have quite achieved the 10 to the 26th number yet. And so I suspect that nobody on the research side has done that either. On the biology side, that number is closer, right? But I suspect it's also true, you know, having talked to many of the large biological model producers, right, in the country, that they're not quite there yet, but the question is more imminent. And so then the question is, who do you deal with? Well, you deal with the Department of Commerce, and the Department of Commerce, as part of the CEO, has stood up something called the AI Safety Institute, or I should say is in the process of standing up the AI Safety Institute. In fact, there was an RFI a couple weeks ago put out by the folks at NIST in a workshop held by
For those who don't speak letters, so RFI is Request for Information, and that is something where the agency says, we're thinking about this, but we would really like to hear from all of you. And they put that out there and they give instructions on how to give information back. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And when you say that people should engage, this is one of the ways that they can engage, is they can try
this
to
is one of the way
look for RFIs and then respond, right? You're given the opportunity to respond. Where does one find these RFIs?
So there are a couple ways to do that. One is that you can find it in the Federal Registrar. And you can also generally find it with the agency that's listing that. Now, as the AI Safety Institute isn't fully stood up yet, there is no, you know, obvious website that you can go to for the AI Safety Institute to find its RFIs yet. We suspect that that will happen somewhat soon. Right now, I think you can rely on NIST for that, because it will be run under NIST. So if you look at NIST.gov and look for their open calls, that's where that would be, in addition to the Federal Registrar. The Federal Registrar has everything in it, right? So that's a larger mass of material.
Which is good and bad, right? It's good because
exactly.
It's in there. It's bad because a lot of stuff you don't want is also in there.
Exactly. So I recommend starting at NIST first and then moving outward. I should also say that in addition to those RFIs, these are not one shot and done, right? There will be a cycle of these things as specific evaluation standards, for instance, around questions like what should the threshold for dual use foundation models look like for biological sequence models? Like that, it's very likely to have another separate RFI associated with that and a separate convening associated with that.
Awesome. Thanks so much. We're getting some great questions in the Q&A. So let me move over to one that we got from the audience. So what international organizations are helping/leading on coordinating laws and regulations across different nations? So this feels really relevant, especially in light of some recent announcements from the EU. You know, we're trying to make rules, they're trying to make rules, these rules aren't necessarily compatible with each other. What's going on there? What should we know?
Yeah, so as we all know, the countries of the world are independent bodies and they can make their own laws. And you know, various parts of the world have chosen to do things slightly differently. The AI Safety Institute in the United States and a lot of the policies that that I just described as part of the EO have been coordinated with both folks on the international side in the EU and in the UK. And in fact, right after the announcement of the EO, we held a joint summit with the folks in the UK. And announced effectively a joint effort with them on the AI Safety Institute. It will take some time for our coordination to fully settle into, you know, a portable set of actions and activities and regulations that can cross the boundary between us and the EU well. But as you have heard, they have just announced that they are, you know, in the process of agreeing to some set of standards. Now, that while we are aware of that, and my office does do that coordination, fact is that, you know, we're going to need some time to, you know, respond to that and also resolve what we have done with what they have done. And of course, there's Congress also in the loop that's coming down the pike. So it's going to take a bit of time to resolve all of those issues in terms of how they get codified into law. But we work with them in terms of what their laws look like and what our laws look like so that there can be better harmony in general.
Excellent. All right. So a bunch of questions we're getting that are about the intersection between the EO and NSF in various ways. So here's one of them. The EO establishes priorities for AI across the executive branch. What priorities could generate exciting new cross-federal opportunities, especially between NSF and emerging partners?
Well, you know, Michael, you might actually be in a better place to talk about this than I am, but I think one of the great visions of the AI research institutes was exactly, to some extent, that, right? How do we get applications to help drive some of the use cases of AI and then, of course, turn them into reality better, right? And NSF is sort of well poised to do that through the expansion of the AI research institutes. But I think I'll let you talk to some of that. I'll also just note that there's the one action we've taken outside of NSF that is designed to help push that is for agencies to work very specifically with NSF on how to harness some of these capabilities.
Yeah, so I mean, there, if you look at the executive order, there's a number of items that are addressed directly to the NSF, things that NSF needs to do. So you can look at those. They include things like creating a couple new AI institutes. But there are also some items where either jointly NSF and another organization, or the other organization is directed to do something, but in connection with NSF. And so we're already starting to have conversations with folks at NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, and the Department of Energy, who have specific things to do under the executive order. And so we're hoping things happen there. I wonder from your perspective though, Wade, so I think part of the executive order is talking about how federal agencies just as a whole should be harnessing AI to just be more efficient, to do things in a way that's safe and fair and productive. I think there are parts of the constellation of federal organizations that are very well informed about what AI is about, and they're looking deeply into the ways that they can deal with that. I'm thinking of NSF, but there's also places like the Patent and Trademark Office. I've been super impressed with the way that they're thinking about AI questions, because they're getting it from all kinds of different directions. But there's other agencies that I think are maybe not part of this wave, and they're not getting informed, and they're not kind of participating. Are there ways that researchers can find out about what those agencies need and maybe engage with those kinds of questions? One of the ways I think about this is that I think industry has done a great job of making academics aware of what their challenges are and getting us engaged with them. I don't think the federal government has done, or the public sector in general, has done as clear a job of communicating to us as academics what we could be doing to help. Have you given that thought?
Absolutely. So there are a couple things I would note there. One is that we recognize that, and I think you recognize, and you know, all of us know, that the various government agencies have different critical masses of their own internal R&D that they conduct, and AI is part of that, right? Like AI is one of those transformative technologies that could potentially, you know, improve the function of those organizations, and therefore should be part of, you know, their bigger R&D strategies. And all government agencies know this. Not all government agencies are resourced in the same way to be able to deal with that. And so the EO does a couple of very useful things to try to remedy this situation in part, right? We can't fully remedy that situation without money. Ultimately, what needs to happen is that there needs to be funding at those agencies that help those agencies, get the AI talent that they need, even define the problems that they need that they have that could be AI addressable, and start engaging with the larger community. But the EO does two things that pushes in that general direction for those kinds of agencies. One thing that it does is it's slightly outside the EO, but like released almost contemporaneously, was OMB's guidance on the usage of AI in the agencies. And it basically says, hey, if you can use these things, you should accelerate these things. But the EO contemporaneously with the MMO, the OMB MMO, which is that guidance, did two other things. It said, hey, we have a pool of talent inside of government that we can allocate to you agencies that do not have very much AI talent for the adoption of AI in your specific agencies. So if you need that talent, please come to us at the White House. And we will coordinate how you get access to many more people than you otherwise would have in order to be able to do this. Now, there are two ways in which the research community should and could engage with that. One is that that talent program allows for us to bring in IPAs. It allows us to bring in people from the research community, a lot like how NSF brings folks in from the research community, a lot like how the Census Bureau brings people in from the research community in order to help supplement their talent needs. And to do so in such a way that, you know, protects their salary, allows them to come for a short period of time, allows them to maintain their original positions in academia, et cetera, but helps them to be able to do exactly the kinds of things that you're describing, right? Which is to identify the problems within agencies that could be AI enabled and help to actually start implementing those things.
All right, and just to clarify for everybody, IPA is Intergovernmental Personnel Agreement, I think.
It's Interagency Personnel Agreement.
Okay, right. Intergovernmental would be
even though it's not actually interagency necessarily.
Right,
it and could so be and between that's non-agencies and government.
Right, and in particular, that's the mechanism whereby NSF hires academics like me to come and work at the NSF for a little while. I think what Wade is saying is that there'll be opportunities for academics to do that, to be paid by a government agency through the university to actually work in the agency for a little while and help them get up to speed, help them do the things that they need to do. So that's really neat. I didn't catch that in the EO. That's cool.
Yeah, in fact, there's actually multiple provisions or provisions for the U.S. Digital Corps, for the PIF program, the Presidential Innovation Fellow program, all of which can use mechanisms like IPAs to bring people into government for a short period of time. And for them to make a difference.
So, okay, a related question that maybe we've a little bit covered, but how can AI researchers help government agencies and other public sector? Well, I guess, yeah, I feel like that is what we just answered. So let me skip that one. How does the AI EO affect children? The children, you must think of the children. And relatedly, K-12 education specifically.
Yeah, good question. So there are provisions within the EO that directly ask the Department of Education to start exploring how AI could improve educational outcomes for children. And so there are a series of provisions along those lines. There are similar provisions that affect HHS in terms of children's health. And so on. So, like, there are many, many of these provisions. I'm not going to get into them in a lot of detail, but I would say that they fall into the categories of specific agency uses of AI, but also in terms of specific protections for populations that are more at risk. And so, if you look through the EO, you will see that there are provisions around NDII, abusive content towards children, and protections around discrimination and usage of AI systems that could affect children who are maybe less savvy users of AI systems.
That's great. Thanks. I like this question. Is there an explicit definition used by the EO for the term trustworthy?
I don't believe that the term trustworthy has a definition associated with it. As you guys know, an EO is a legal document, but not all words get definitions because some of them are sort of accepted as default. That's not an obvious one either to me, right? To you, to me, to anybody else. It could mean a lot of different things. So I don't know that it actually exists in the EO. I think the EO does try to clarify what are high risk versus low risk systems, which it actually makes concrete distinctions between in terms of how regulations apply. So there, it's much more, you know, there a definition really matters in the sense of like how the EO applies. And for that, there is a much more concrete definition.
So how should we be thinking about it then? So is it just sort of casually like we're caring about systems that don't break in ways that hurt people? or don't work correctly in ways that
no yeah. Actually, what I would say is that you know, if you look at the EO, you will find that the risks are actually very clearly categorized, right? They're categorized in terms of biosafety risks, risks to critical infrastructure, cybersecurity risks, and then a series of risks associated with privacy, bias, discrimination, et cetera, largely echoing what you've seen in, for instance, the AI, the blueprint for an AI Bill of Rights, and the definitions that are in the AI RMF, you know, that were published by NIST. And so trustworthy is an, you know, you should think of as an encompassing, summarizing term associated with those things. But you know, I wouldn't rely on the word trustworthy. I would actually rely on the denominated set of risks. That's what I'm really trying to tell you there.
Okay. I hope, yeah, I think that's somewhat clear. So regarding safe use of AI, what types of labels are being developed? Will the labels be tested slash confirmed by the USG? So the picture I get in my head from this question is something kind of like movies, right? Where you go to the movies, like a movie gets labeled as this is okay for children, this is not okay for children, this is okay for right. only grownups, this is okay for only depraved grownups. Like whatever the labeling system happens to be, is there a system like that underway with regard to AI systems?
Well, as you all know, there are many competing labeling systems that have been proposed by both industry and nonprofit organizations, civil society organizations across the world. I think this is a time for us to figure out what is the right kind of system for us. And what the EO says is basically that commerce will figure out with the larger R&D community, with you all, what are the right systems for that. I think that there are going to be a number of trade-offs associated with this. So for instance, you know, to first approximation, you might think, well, I'll just label content as being AI generated. But the problem is that it's not that simple, right? Sometimes AI generated content is actually partially derived, fully derived from human content, or there may be humans in the production chain associated with partially generated content. And so we're going to have to figure out exactly what those standards mean and what they portend, especially in these fuzzier gray areas. And similarly, when we start dealing with derived and modified content, we're going to need to be thinking through what it means in terms of watermarking standards, right? As you all know, developing good watermarking systems that can capture those kinds of partial derivative kinds of associations back to their original provenance are actually pretty hard to do well, unless you have a whole chain of actions that you can categorize and audit, right?
Got it. All right. So things are, like you said, there's multiple systems. People are still kind of working through what might stick at a higher level. There's a bunch of variations of this question. Will there be specific funding opportunities at the NSF related to this executive order?
Well, again, I think you're probably in a better place to talk about this, but the thing that I would highlight immediately is that there are piloting efforts going on with the NAIR, and that there are the National AI Research Resource, which is a compute infrastructure and data infrastructure and largely AI supportive infrastructure that is meant to help the research community. So there are opportunities there, maybe not exactly in terms of direct funding, but in terms of capability to work with these resources in early pilot stages. And then beyond that, I think that there, you know, the expansion of the AI research institutes bring with them potential funding associated with that. The bigger funding levers are going to have to come from Congress. So we, you know, on the executive side, we don't have the power of the purse that Congress does. That is ultimately decided by Congress. What we can do is within what's already allocated, you know, shift things that are within the, you know, within the bounds of what Congress allows. And we have done that appropriately. But I think that there are potentially many more opportunities that are going to come from the next wave of activities that involve the congressional side of action.
Interesting. And so it's probably, I guess we're both in the executive branch, right? Wade, me and you both kind of.
That's right.
That piece. We don't get to, we allocate money that we get. And we can't even, I think at NSF anyway, we can't really even ask for money. We can't sort of go to Congress and say, hey, you should be giving us more money for such and such, because that's, I think, considered lobbying. So obviously we're giving input in the ways that are appropriate, as you said, Wade. I guess we could, are there things coming down the pike? I don't even know if we can talk about that. But as you said, Wade, there's the National AI Research Resource, which I think in just a few days, there's going to be some kind of announcement about opportunities to ask for those resources so that you can, to support your research. It's just a pilot at this point, so we won't be able to support everybody, but we really do want to support some really interesting projects. And so there's going to be that opportunity to get cycles and data and other quantities like that for your work. And Wade mentioned the AI institutes. There's going to be four new institutes. That's the call for proposals is already out. The solicitation is out. So you should be looking at those and figuring out a way to fit with it. And I think, what I'm seeing, at least on the NSF side, is kind of being inspired to be in line with the EO. Not that the EO said specifically we're going to, NSF is going to add this new funding opportunity, but we can see where the excitement is, we can see where the needs are, and so we're going to try to find ways to help the research community address those needs in various ways. And so I think the answer, at least from our perspective, is kind of stay tuned.
Yeah, and I would say that beyond NSF, you should also note that DARPA and ARPA-E and ARPA-H, and also parts of NIH have efforts that they are funding that are in line with the EO on AI usage as well. And then on top of that, the new entity that will at some point, although I don't know exactly when, be looking for folks to conduct funded research will be the AI Safety Institute.
Okay. When can we hear more about the AI Safety Institute? Because I'm super curious.
Well, so I think that they've had one of their, as I said, RFIs to sort of introduce some of their problems to the world that they're interested in thinking about. And that's going to be the beginning of a sequence of those engagements. I don't know exactly when the next one of those will come about, but they are looking to collaborate very explicitly with the R&D community on some of the safety trustworthiness evaluation problems that they're interested in. And there will at some point be a call associated with that. I don't know exactly when.
Thanks, Wade. All right, so another question. Some of the priorities you outlined, probably you, Wade, requires training of a diverse cadre of researchers, engineers, and practitioners for not only building and deploying AI technologies, but also for addressing the human and societal implications of such technologies. Do you envision funding for interdisciplinary training and retraining programs at the undergraduate and graduate levels?
Yeah, so very good question. So the EO says that some existing training programs need to be directed in this way. And again, we have some limitations in terms of the dollars that we can actually reallocate in that way. But I think that the next step is exactly what you described, you who wrote the question. We need to figure out how to scale that up to a wider community of folks. So for instance, one of the directives in the EO is a directive to the Department of Labor to use its existing funds to try to understand and run studies around the impacts of AI on society. And that's already gonna involve, if you think about it, a multidisciplinary group of experts, social scientists, technologists, policy people coming together to be able to do that effectively. And that's the first step of what's plausible in an executive order. But a larger scale version of that ultimately needs to happen. And so we're totally with you. And Congress needs to act. And we should all be helping Congress to figure out how it should act in that way.
And consistent with Wade's answer, NSF hasn't gotten any additional funding to support this sort of thing, but we are trying to, within the funding that we have, reallocate things as best we can. And we issued a Dear Colleague letter just last week, or if not the previous week, on the topic of AI education. So basically, how can we be better supporting the educational community in trying to figure out how AI should be taught and how to create that kind of next generation of experts who can be contributing in their way. All right, awesome. I guess sort of related to that, does the government already have any ethical regulation for use of AI for K-12 and higher education?
Yes. So there are a number of standards. Well, first of all, the EO actually calls for the development of more of those standards, specifically around around the risks associated with AI systems and their deployment in education. So the Department of Ed has been asked to do that on a very, very short timeline. But even before that, the release of the M memo sets broader guidance that affects the Department of Education, and therefore the larger educational system indirectly. And it basically says, hey, if you're going to deploy AI systems, they have to have these kinds of characteristics in terms of discrimination, in terms of bias, in terms of differential outcomes for different communities, in terms of performance. They have to be assessed in those ways and before they're deployed. And so those broader bits of guidance affect all uses by government. And on top of that, there are very specific uses that the Department of Ed has associated with in draft guidance. And then what's coming is a codification that's asked for in the EO. Now, those of you that understand the educational space, especially the K-12 educational space, you already know that there are a series of additional privacy protections that already affect those spaces, namely FERPA, right, and associated laws. That govern how educational IT gets used. And a lot of those things just carry over directly. So these are all layered on top of FERPA and on top of existing Department of Ed guidance.
Thanks. And I'm seeing in the queue, there's several other related questions that hopefully your answer covered as well as you can. To what extent, all right, so I don't know. I think this is a really interesting one. To what extent is the OSTP AI agenda driven by industry, which has taken a particular stance on AI technologies, especially around large language models and the like, as opposed to a host of foundational research issues that need to be addressed that are not receiving as much attention in industry?
Yeah, so, we have to listen to all stakeholders and represent ultimately the American people, right? That's OSTP is part of the White House. That's our goal here. We don't represent companies and we don't represent any specific organizations, but we do have to think holistically about the American people as a whole. And so, there are, as you can see, a lot of the focus of the EO is in terms of non-commercial applications of AI and how they will get developed, how the core R&D of AI will happen, beyond what companies are doing now. I think there are many core foundational questions that are not going to result in profit in the very short term that we need to be thinking about. So for instance, how do we think about methods for assuring upfront in terms of how the models are architected and designed and the algorithms for training these models are designed, safety and trustworthiness, right? Like we don't actually have those kinds of technologies, but somebody should conduct the research to actually figure those things out, right? Similarly, what does the next generation of AI models that is not viable today in any technical way, right? What do those look like? That basic research needs to happen, right? And if you thought about a lot of the underlying AI safety and trustworthiness work, well, that is not the fundamental concern of most of these companies, right? That is not their profit driver. That is something that we need to make public investments in order to make real world differences associated with that. So, you know, we listen to that community. That community has a lot of smart people associated with it, and they have legitimate interests, and sometimes they align with the interests of the entire American public, but not always. And when they don't, then we need to listen to other people too.
Thanks, Wade. And I would add that, you know, on the NSF side, we're being responsive to the fact that to this moment in time where large language models are getting a lot of the attention, but we're also making sure that the rest of the field is continuing to be supported, right? So we're not turning down non-LLM proposals just because they're not about LLMs. And in fact, we're not accepting LLM proposals just because they are LLMs. Like we evaluate the proposals with respect to their intellectual merit and their broader impact, and we're going to continue to do that. So yeah, please, we very much view our role at the NSF as making sure the ideas that are going to fuel the future in 20 years have been put in place and have been studied. And so we're trying not to be fad driven, even though we do need to be responsive to what's going on. All right, we are 7 minutes from close down time. I've got so many wonderful questions. So I'm not going to be able to get through all of them, but let me see if I can squeeze in just a couple more. A precursor for testing is functional requirement / specification, which AI is usually less well-defined than traditional software. Is there a focus for advancing this challenge / need for testing AI?
I think so. Although it's a tricky business, and I think it's going to require more R&D, as you might have figured out from all of my answers on these kinds of questions, right? We have a technology that's a bit more general purpose than I think any of us originally realized when we built some of these things, right? And so as they're being used in more and more domains, you know, the functional requirements part of this gets harder and harder to define. They get more and more open-ended. But I think that's a great research challenge to be thinking through, right? Like, what are the functional requirements that could help drive better evaluation, definition of evaluations and metrics and so on? And how do we deal with that? So I'm all for it. You should do that research and we should talk about how that gets done.
Yeah, fantastic. All right. According to a Nature article, about 30% of the academics surveyed admitted to relying on AI, LLMs specifically, to generate text for research proposal. Does the EO / NSF have a stance on ground rules for use of AI in such a context?
Good question. I don't know that the EO gets that specific, but NSF, you guys might have more explicit guidance in this regard.
Yeah, we were working on something over a long period of time that I think may have come out yesterday. So I can send I don't know how to send out the link, but there's definitely an NSF kind of memo type thing on the use of large language models in grant proposal writing. Our stance is essentially, you know, you can't use a large language model to plagiarize. Like, just because it's written by a large language model and it's taking someone else's research and claiming it as yours, that doesn't protect you from plagiarism. You need to be responsible for that. But we're okay with people using large language models to help with the readability of their proposal, right? We know that a lot of the more well-researched universities, resourced universities, not researched, have the ability to hire people to come in and help with the readability of your proposals. We will, to the extent that you can use large language models to help with that, we are in favor of that. I think that's a democratizing force. But the content is your responsibility. If the proposal says you're going to do something, just because the language model says you're going to do it, that's not. That you need to be responsible for that. And so the details of the way that we are expressing that is now available as of again yesterday. I encourage you to take a look at it.
I'm curious if you're going to require labeling.
Yeah, no, apparently, and I did not know this, but apparently NSF already has a rule pre-language models that says if somebody helps you with the writing, be it your graduate student or some kind of paid writer, you're supposed to flag that in the proposal. You're not supposed to just pass it off as your writing. So I don't know that people generally do that, but they're supposed to. And the large language model kind of thing is piggybacking on top of that. If you use a large language model to generate the text, just tell us as part of the proposal. You're allowed to do it, but it's better if you tell us that you did it so that we can put it in the proper context when it's being evaluated. And hopefully that's also covered in the document that came out. It was certainly covered by the committee that was working on this. Yeah, it's a great question. Thanks, Wade. This is definitely for you. What's the anticipated / plan / desired timeline to cast the framework from the executive order into law, being aware of all the different areas to be properly addressed?
Yeah, good question. I wish I knew the answer to when Congress would act. This is a tricky business these days. There's a bunch of back and forth between us and members and staff in terms of, you know, what we think the right priorities are and, you know, how they're drafting legislation and so on. So the discussions are already happening, but the issue is that, you know, as you all know, a number of these things will require funding. And when they do require funding, they need to be tied to appropriate funding bills. And then there's a question as to when Congress will actually get to the point where they're passing a number of those bills. So there are a number of different opportunities there, but it's a little hard for me to predict exactly when that's going to happen. What I would tell you, though, is that if you are following what Congress is doing, you will see that they're holding hearings. The kind of hearings they need to be holding to be thinking through what the implications of these technologies are, what the problems they need to solve are, what parts of the EO they need to codify because they will, you know, they will expire otherwise, or what parts they need to bolster in terms of funding and so on. So they're definitely thinking this through, and it's a very bipartisan effort. So I think that there's a very good chance that, however the work gets structured, that if we can find some place to land in terms of legislation, it will get enacted.
All right. We are now within 60 seconds of the end of the broadcast, the webinar. I have a huge pile of great questions. Thank you, everybody, for sending in your questions and for being engaged with this topic. We're not going to be able to get through the rest of them. Wade, is there anything that people can do to get more questions answered offline? What would you suggest?
Yeah, well, you can reach out to our office and specifically me. You can also go to AI.gov. There are ways to contact us through that. And so that's where our office is on the web. I should have told you that earlier.
AI.gov, because they get to pick all the best names.
You got it.
Good one. All right.
And if you want to
also
be at NSF. Order, it's there. Sorry.
And the executive order is there. Wendy and Catherine Harrington, Wendy Nielsen and Catherine Harrington have been kind of lurking in the background, trying to make things run smoothly, feeding questions. I want to thank them for doing that. They also posted a couple links, including the link to the NSF policy on the use of large language models and generative AI. And I think links to some of the things that Wade was talking about as well. So hopefully you can grab those before this closes any second now. Thank you, everybody, for participating. Wade, thank you so much for taking time out to help keep us informed about what's going on and how we can interact with this moment in AI.
Thank you all for your help, and we look forward to engaging with you all as the EO gets implemented.